Hear that?
Pumpkin.
That's fall calling. And the pumpkin spice latte is back at Starbucks. From that first sweater to late autumn weather, it's all a fall in just one sip. Order ahead on the Starbucks app.
If you can't have positive cash flow, that is a sign that your real estate's overvalued.
Hello, everybody. It's Jake Stenziano, host of the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, here with my co-host, the multi-family mentor, the coach, the chef, the father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbo. Gino, how's it going?
Mr. Stenziano, I am doing good. Back from Tennessee. The kids are having a little withdrawal from the Stenzi family. Had to get them out of the house today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Coming off a high weekend, I just want to say thank you to everyone that came out this weekend for our Money Mixer. Tremendous event and a lot of learning going on. We saw the B's, we saw the C's, we saw the A's, and I think there's some great networking going on. So big shout out to everybody for that. Today we have a very special guest. Today's guest is Harry Dent, author of Zero Hour and The Great Boom Ahead. Harry studied economics in college, and after turning his back on his chosen profession, threw himself into the new science of finance and studying demographic, technological, and consumer trends. Today, Harry uses the research he developed from years of hands-on business experience to offer readers a positive, easy-to-understand view of the economic future by heading up Dent Research. So without further ado, Harry, welcome to the show.
Oh, nice to be here, guys.
Hey, thanks for coming on. Let's get this started. Tell us a little bit about your business background and how you got started.
Well, I always tell people I did not aspire to be an economist when I was growing up. I mean, no chance of getting laid, for one thing. But I was interested in predicting the future, and I was interested in cycles, and I got introduced to that in my father-in-law, who's a major private investor, took all these gold bug newsletters in the 70s. So I got into cycles, and I majored in economics, and I took three courses and said, to hell with this. This is a waste of time. These people don't understand people because they've never had sex. They understand business because they've never run a business. So what do they understand about the economy? And economists don't think you can predict the future past the next election. So I majored in everything else, business, finance, accounting, strategic planning, went to Harvard Business School, consulted the Fortune 100 companies at Bain & Company in strategic planning. Got bored with large, it was a great company, still rated number one, two best company to work for the last decade. But I was bored with the clients, dinosaur Fortune 100 companies appealing to old people who were still shopping at Sears, okay? And so I started consulting to new ventures. I got an offer to turn around a company in California that was failing, and then got into that arena. And that's when I learned the most. I discovered the baby boom because these new ventures in California were appealing to young baby boomers just entering the economy, adopting new technology, starting new trends. And I studied them for my clients and found out, oh my gosh, nobody understands the size of this baby boom coming and what it's going to do to the economy when they grow up and get off of pot and drugs and alcohol, okay? And, you know, hippies to yuppies, I used to call it. That was the biggest thing that changed the economy from an inflationary recession in the 70s to the greatest boom in history from the 80s beyond. It was just people growing up, becoming responsible, having families, and what do? Oh, they move in apartments, and then they buy their starter home, then they buy their trade-up home, and eventually they buy a vacation home they can afford, and blah, blah, blah. And they end up where? In a damn nursing home, if they can afford it these days. So real estate, so I discovered demographics, but more important, I discovered the size of the baby boom and how big an impact it had. In the 80s, when everybody thought the US was done and Japan was gonna take over the world, I was saying, no, Japan's about to be done. They had an early baby boom. They're already urban, they've already done everything. They're going to collapse in the 90s, and the U.S. and Europe are going to see their best decade ever, and this boom's going to continue in different sectors. So I discovered the size of the baby boom. I discovered the power of demographics, and real estate is one of the most demographic. I mean, everything's demographics. I mean, people eat the most potato, will buy the most potato chips at 42 for their kids who are at the peak of their calorie cycle at age 14. This is the power of demographic. Life insurance actuaries can tell you anywhere in the world, male or female, at any age, when you're going to die on average. They can't tell when you're going to die. They can tell a large group of people when the average person is going to die. I do the same thing. I'm like Dr. Demographics, you know, like Rain Man, like people, shorts at Walmart, age 46, you know, life insurance, age 55. I can put a number on the peak spending of about just any major consumer category. And again, we'll get into this, but one of the surprises in recent times is this innovative. I also saw how innovative the baby boomers were. Generation before, conformists like the Japanese and East Asian today, you know, they have a virus, they wear masks and blah, blah, good for the country. We say, hey, tell us my shotgun, okay? That's the U.S. The baby boomers, an innovative generation, change everything they go into, every category. Guess what they're changing right now? Multi-family rental apartments. Older people buy. They don't rent. Young people rent. Well, not now. And I'll get into that. So things change by age, consumer categories, especially real estate. Each generation comes along and they start new trends and things, and then you can track those. And the baby boom, even though they're now old, 50s to 80s, okay? They're starting to die, by the way. They are still the dominant demographic force because it was such a wave of buyers. So anything you can do to appeal to them, even though there's fewer categories that they will spend more in, a lot fewer, like healthcare, nursing homes, and assisted living. Well, it's starting to show that apartments may be one of those. And that may be the biggest opportunity in your industry.
Jake, we can go anywhere with this recording, this podcast, because Harry's throwing so many things at us right now. There's 10,000 people a day turning 65. So that's an amazing statistic. Think about that. There's about 150 million baby boomers and millennials. So there's a huge swath of people out there. Harry, I was wondering if we could rewind just real quick and just talk about this last cycle we've had from 2010 to 2020. There really wasn't a recession in that. And isn't it true that it's the only decade really that hasn't had a recession? And what do you see the difference in this cycle? Now the pandemic just really slammed the brakes on everything. But what is you see that's different with this current cycle that is in, you know, in past cycles? Do you see any big differences?
Well, that's very simple. About $25 trillion now dollars printed out of thin air by central banks to keep an economy that actually should have not just seen a recession as they did, a deep recession in 2008 to 9, the GFC, they call it, the great financial crisis. Should have seen a depression. Mm-hmm. That was the end of the baby boom spending cycle, the greatest in history, the end of a great bubble in real estate and stocks, just as Japan had seen before, because they had their baby boom earlier. And we should have gone deeper, but it started going so deep that these central banks just said, well, we can't have this deep a downturn. We can't have a Great Depression and high unemployment and the failure of banks and major companies. Like all that 2008 was looking exactly like 1930. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was predicting would happen. Well, they turned on the spigot. They decided, you know what? We got a new tool. It's called quantitative easing. This is a newer tool that they've only used a little bit in the past. They just blew it right out. The U.S. and everybody first, and Mario Draghi when the euro crisis happened. You know who's been printing the most money compared to the economy? Japan. Because Japan had the biggest crash first. You know their real estate went down 60-some percent in the early 90s and has never bounced 30 years later? Mm-hmm. That's what happens when a generation the size of the baby boom ages and stops buying real estate, normal real estate. Mm-hmm. So this is what happened. We were going into the deepest downturn, deeper than the early 80s, more like the 30s, and central banks said no. So normally, and you said something else important, Gina, normally we do have a recession about every 10 years. The most likely time is the first 2 to 3 years of every decade, early 60s, early 70s, early 80s, early 90s, early 2000s.
You're right.
This one, 2008-9 came early because of the peak of the baby boom spending, which I forecast that 25 years for what happened. 25 years, regardless of who's president, regardless of anything else, because that's a predictable thing, when masses of people will spend more or not. So that recession came early. This one's coming late because it's been postponed. And this entire boom entire boom since early 2009 is totally artificial. Debt levels were already high, never allowed to deleverage in the crisis like they did in the Great Depression or even in the early 80s crisis. Debt levels are much higher now because of this easy free money. Demographic trends are even deeper down, which I predicted would be down in from 2008 to 2023, what I call the winter season of the economy, the decline of the baby boom generation spending cycle, like 69 to 82 for the Bob Hope generation before them, predictable again. And yet we've had the stocks go to the highest prices ever and the real estate boom bubble, higher than a second real estate bubble after the GFC, after the 2008 recession. Neither of these bubbles would have happened without 25 trillion freaking stupid ass something for nothing dollars printed out of thin air by academic economists who've never run a business or had sex and think they know how to run the economy better than the free market system, which since the late 1700s, along with democracy, have been the two biggest trends in all of history, trumping the agricultural revolution so bad doesn't even look like a revolution, okay? That's what's been happening the last decade. The worst thing possible, and Japan is the perfect evidence, because 30 years after their baby boom crash and what would have been their depression, and they printed money to get out of it and avoided deleveraging debt, which you're supposed to do, they're still in a coma economy. Japan has grown zero average the last 25 years with zero inflation. That's a coma economy. They're having just enough life support from free money not to have a deeper downturn, but they will never, ever grow again with that strategy. And we're headed in the same direction.
So, Harry, real quick, what do they do? They have, I guess, 177 million people. Their immigration, at least us, we have immigrants coming in to innovate. Right. We have cheap labor. They have a strict immigration policy. So how do they get out of it? Because they're stuck.
The Japanese don't want immigrants. They don't have a strict. First of all, immigrants move to English-speaking countries from emerging countries typically so they can rise in their standard of living and they can get their kids an English-speaking education at a good university. Are you going to send them to Tokyo where people don't speak English and they don't teach in English? No. They go to California. They go to Vancouver. They go to London. They go to Singapore. They go to Australia, Melbourne. That's where they go. Even if Japan wanted immigrants, which they don't because they are a superior culture, and they are a damn good culture, by the way, very together, very homogeneous, and very happy, they don't want immigrants, even if they try to be hard to get them. South Korea is now trying, as their economy goes down 22 years after Japan, which is exact lag on their baby boom peak, and I predicted that decades ago. They're trying to get immigrants with a little bit of success, but I've spoken in South Korea many times. Only the young people speak some English. Old people don't speak any English there. So it's not. So immigration is a big advantage, and now we're losing our immigration since 2001. Ours is down, and we have an anti-immigration sentiment, very bad mistake, because all developed countries are aging. All developed countries will never have the demographic trends they had coming into 2007 or so, and every developed country should be competing for the best immigrants in the emerging world.
Well, Harry, not everyone's having six kids like me, so we have to import a bunch of people here. So that's the problem with, you look at Europe, they have negative birth rates, and they need that. So when you're talking about that demographic, that's really hard to...
Now, real quick, immigrants are most typically 23, on average 30. They are the perfect moving into a new kind, perfect apartment renters as well. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to understand they're flooding the market with all this money, right? And then you're seeing, okay, stocks being propped up, real estate being propped up. How does inflation play into this? Because you said the inflation in Japan's been stagnant, but is it just a surplus of money so people are willing to pay more for this stuff? So I'm trying to get my head wrapped around here.
That's a great point, Jake. This is where the gold bugs are wrong. They sound like when I give a presentation with a gold bug like Peter Schiff, our presentations look the same for the first half. You can't grow on debt forever, and debt bubbles always burst, and blah, 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 blah. They see consumer price inflation and therefore say gold will be the best investment. I was like, no, no, no. We're not getting consumer price inflation because this $25 trillion is not going to consumers or into the banking system be lent. It's going into financial markets. They're buying financial assets, the same pool of financial assets, real estate, stocks, bonds, and gold, and all this sort of stuff, with more money coming out of nowhere, which just pushes up financial assets. The inflation is in financial assets, including real estate. And that is the bubble that's going to burst, not that we're going to have hyperinflation and consumer prices. $25 trillion, how much consumer inflation has it caused? Zero in Japan, 2% in the U.S., 1% in Europe. $25 trillion. If we'd have printed that at any time in history, we'd have damn near runaway inflation. So that's the thing to understand. So that's the problem with real estate. I've got a quote in all my books. Real estate will never be the same after a larger generation is followed by a smaller generation in magnitude and acceleration. We will never need to build another home in the United States ever. China's already built more than they need for the next 10 to 15 years, and their demographics are starting to peak. Japan has 8 million empty homes going on 15 million. And we've got a real estate bubble that we have not seen in history, unless we go back to the 1840s that burst with the Midwest expansion, okay? Real estate has bubbled up. Stocks bubble up more often. Real estate bubbles are rare. Real estate will come down in price back to fair value and grow more, which it has traditionally, with replacement cost and the value of the rents. I don't care whether you're a landlord renting out. If you're buying at prices, then you have to rent at negative gearing, at losses, and make it on depreciation. You're going to fail. And if you're a home buyer, the reason you buy a home, other than to fix it up and have your own place with a white picket fence, is to save rents. If you're paying way more than the rents you're saving, then you're an idiot. I have been living in a rental primary home since late 2005, when I saw the first bubble coming, and I was moving from Tampa to Miami. So that real estate will go back to, you buy it because you want to live in it or use it for your business, strategic to your business. Otherwise, you rent it. And what's it worth? The rents that it can generate. So you measure real estate, price to incomes, and equally important, price to rents. And that'll tell you if it's overvalued or not. That's going to mean people who have cash flow positive real estate that they're renting out are going to be the winners in this deflation of real estate. And people who own overvalued real estate are going to lose their assets, financial assets called real estate, including stocks and everything else. So this is a critical time. A great reset. This happened 29 to 32, 1837 to 1842. Those bottoms are exactly 90 years. I've been saying for 20 some years, we'll have a crisis, the worst of a crisis between 2020 and 22. And that's also in that same 10-year recession cycle on top of a lot of others. So this is a critical time. People with reasonably valued real estate, people who are renting rather than selling, are going to do better. Rentals hold up. Less people will be able to buy than even now for the new millennial generation. And it, as I hinted earlier, retiring baby boomers are for the first generation to say, oh my God, we didn't save for retirement because we lived in la-la land and didn't think we'd need to, thought we'd retire in a house. And now the only asset I have is an overvalued McMansion, and they are selling that McMansion increasingly. Not buying a smaller retirement home. They are using that entire profit to fund their retirement plan that they never had, and they're renting, increasingly renting their retirement homes. That's the opportunity in rental multifamily. Higher end, higher service, aiming at aging baby boomers who realize their real estate's overvalued, they don't need it anyway, and they're so bad, it's saving for retirement that they're only, baby boomers would not do this by choice. They're being forced to because they never save.
But Harry and Jake,
good for your group.
I need to make a few.
Would you rather rent to a 27-year-old crack addict or a 65-year-old sane person that, you know?
I need to make a few observations. First thing we like to say at Jake and Gino, if it don't cash flow, let the grass grow. It's as simple as that.
Exactly.
That's the first observation.
That is the first measure. That's why price to rents is my more, I value that more than even price to income. You run out of buyers if prices get too high in any category, including billionaires can't afford to buy on South Central Park in Manhattan hardly anymore. But price to rents, exactly. If you can't have positive cash flow, that is a sign that your real estate's overvalued.
The second thing is the middle class is getting crushed as usual. We always talk about the middle class. So people who own assets, hard assets like multifamily, we are inflating. We're keeping up with rents because when they get a 4% increase in wages, what happens to rents? Rents go up 3 to 4%. We're able to refinance our properties. We've been able to refinance over $9 million on our portfolio and have a really pretty low loan to value on our portfolio and just keep repositioning into other assets that are continuing to inflate. Middle class can't do that. I think the last thing is everyone thinks about saving for an event, like saving for college. And I was into that, saving for my retirement. I want everyone out there in our community who listens to this podcast has a notion you want to buy an asset to pay for that event. Because when the event is over, like my first child going to college, I still have that asset. My second child is up to bat now. That asset is paying for it. Principal pay down.
That's the college
fund. Continuing to cash flow, the cost segregation, because we can't forget about cost segregation and the tax benefits and the 1031 that have also put fuel to the fire here, because those two have stimulated multifamily. And I think going forward, there's so many things going on. The demographic cliff. I think everyone needs to pick up the book. This is a fantastic book. You read it. I mean, it's a lot of stuff in here. It's not easy reading, but this is an easy stuff. And I want everyone to go out there. And if you don't, if that's too hard, start with this book, Penny Candy Books. My kids are starting to read this. I'm a homeschooler. We homeschool our kids. I'm going to have them read this. And then I'm going to have them graduate to this because this is important. It's all about demographics. And when you're out there raising capital, you need to talk to investors and start with them and give them the story of why multifamily. You can talk about the cycles. You can talk about what Harry's been mentioning on the podcast, but it really comes down to demographics and why multifamily has been inflating.
Also, Gina, this is bubble, because it's a deflation of all risky financial assets. Apartments and medical facilities and a few other things is going to be the only thing that's going to hold up, both with demographics and with the fact, you know, that rents do better. More people have to rent in the downturn. So the rental cycle of the millennials is already peaking in 2018-19, okay, just naturally at age 27. You know, as soon as people get married, they start, they don't all, but they start to buy houses when they can afford them. So that goes down. But they haven't bought houses as much as the baby boomers because they couldn't afford to. The banks tightened up and they saw real estate go down. Baby boomers never saw real estate. They're like, wait a minute. You mean I could buy a home and lose money on it? Nobody ever thought of that one.
Yes.
So they're more cautious. Their rental cycle will be extended by this downturn I'm looking at into 2022-23. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. But coming out of that, it will be this, the baby boomers will even more so say, what's the use of owning real estate when I just had my ass handed to me? And again, buying stuff that you weren't making money on, buying stuff just so it would go up, or even staying in a McMansion, even though you don't need it just because, well, it's going up. Why would I sell this thing, you know, sort of thing. They're going to be even more inclined to say, why don't I rent in retirement? I've been telling people to do that anyway. Deploy your capital in better investments than overvalued real estate in your retirement. So these are the two big trends. So the downturn is only in favor of your segment and medical facility. I would buy REITs if I was an investor, or I would tell people if you have cash flow positive real estate, that's something you can hold. But here's a more important insight. If a lot of people are going to lose money in real estate and the economy is going to be bad, and even some apartment buildings will fail because people don't pay their rents or something. If you have cash flow positive real estate, you will be able to take over failed buildings. It may even be hotels or something that you can turn into an apartment building that's failing. Or people are taking over McMansions and turning them into assisted living facilities for six or seven clients, getting 2 to 3 times the rent you would get from renting it out. you can take over failed things in Chapter 11 or bankruptcy with just your cash flow. You don't have to put up money. The bank is say, oh, I got a failed client. If I can take this asset and give it to you at a discounted value and you just take over this much of the mortgage, or maybe just the mortgage, it's yours. So there's gonna be advantage to expand. So your positive cash flow makes you a creditworthy client in a downturn, and you get to pick up properties that are failing, because a lot of properties will be failing. And again, some of them won't be traditional. I'm hearing people talking about turning malls into apartment centers and shopping, yes, just like the Leading Edge apartment complexes.
Great locations,
now.
Right?
Yeah, yes. Where you have a high-end apartment thing, but you have Starbucks and some stores and some bars and stuff all there at your convenience. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of real estate that may be able to be converted that are failing that you can pick up for nothing and expand your business. And now you can have even better cash flow over off those, you know, very astute investments.
I want everyone to write this down because it's important. We've been talking about it. The four reasons for multifamily. The first one is cash flow. Everyone, number two is appreciation. Number three are tax benefits. And number four, which I think we've hammered on this podcast, is cycle resiliency. I think multifamily assets are going to be cycle resilient. Obviously, we're going to have bumps in the road, but when you have long-term fixed rate financing, if you think about your three pillars of real estate, which is the market cycle, which is your debt, and number three is your exit strategy. If you have long-term fixed rate financing and you can ride out the wave, because the only time you lose in real estate is if you have to sell. And if you have a cash flowing asset and you can ride out the wave, that's what happened back in 08. A lot of people bet and they had collateralized mortgages and collateralized debt. And it's ironic. My house that I bought here a year and a half ago, unfortunately, Harry, I have to buy because six kids renting a home is just a nightmare. But my price is just getting back to the 2007 level where this gentleman bought. So, you know, there's certain areas where we haven't even reached those crazy yeah, levels. So I think everyone just think about that. Always think about the three pillars of real estate. We talk about the market cycle, where it is, your debt, what kind of debt you're going to put on, and what's your exit strategy? Are you going to hold these long term? Are you going to flip them? Are you going to refinance them? That's really important. Now, Harry, what I wanted to ask you was, what areas in the U.S. do you see really taking advantage? Because Jake and I talk about the blue versus red. We don't want to talk about politics. We like to talk about policy versus politics.
And population, jobs.
Yeah, I moved to Florida 3 years ago from New York. Best thing I ever did. To convince my wife and kids, it was tough. I have grandparents yelling at me, telling me you're taking away my kids. But I said, you know what? It's going to be good for the long term. And I think you guys are all going to come down with me. So what areas do you see really taking advantage of? And there's big, really growth centers in the U.S.
Well, first of all, more affordable areas and areas southeast, mm-hmm, and southwest. Now, this has been a trend, and I've been talking about this for decades. All my books usually have some reference to this. People steadily been moving from more expensive and colder areas. So why pay more to live in a colder area? Well, because those used to be the great areas. You know, Chicago and Detroit were great, and automobile era, and New York and the Northeast have always been the richest, and that California was the up-and-coming place. All those places got expensive, except maybe the Midwest. So people have been moving, and they've been moving, but they've been moving more, like in Florida. I moved from San Francisco to Miami at first. But in Florida, the growth was more in Tampa and Orlando because it was more affordable than Palm Beach, Fort Lauderdale, and Miami. And in Atlanta, Dallas, more than Houston. Used to be Austin, but it's no longer as affordable. Phoenix, places like that, these have been the growth cities. It's good, and it's both younger new families move there because they see better job opportunities and lower cost living, better schools, climate for their kids. But again, aging baby boomers, if they have a choice. And it is a myth that most aging people move to Arizona, Florida. They don't. But enough of them do to give a huge advantage to places, states like that. Mm-hmm. So aging baby boomers, they can. Of course. I mean, I have a very high income. I love a lot of cities, Vancouver, New York. Yeah, I can name a bunch of them. I wouldn't live there if you put a shotgun to my head. I'm not going to live in a cold city. I'm too old for that, okay? It's just too hard to put on a coat and have to jump start my car with a, jumper
There's
cable.
There's a simpler life out there.
Get the snow off. Yeah, so... So those are the areas that are already more affordable, particularly Dallas is one of the great. I mean, Texas, low taxes, low cost housing. My God, it's just, and Tampa and Orlando and Phoenix. Phoenix is more overvalued than Las Vegas, but they will come out. Those areas will continue to do well. And the Northeast and the upper Midwest and California, particularly Northern California, will do less well.
I love that. Before we get to the personal growth section, what other asset classes are you looking at, are you interested in, or you think is going to have positive impacts going forward?
Well, I'll tell you, the recent crash just told that story very quickly. Almost none. Even investment-grade corporate bonds got hit, because you could have a AAA rating, but if you're in the cruise ship or hotel or endless other, you know, airline business, you became a junk bond regardless when your sales fall 50, 80% rather than maybe 10% in a normal recession. So in the only thing that did well and countered the stock downturn of 40% roughly was treasury bonds, 10 and 30 year treasury bonds that went up about 24% at best. Investment grade bonds went down almost as much as junk. Gold went up at first. Oh, crisis, then oh, deep crisis like 2008, down. But gold held up better than other things. But it's really high quality bonds. And this downturn, people say, oh, well, just get cash or buy gold. No, gold is going to go down somewhere in that crisis like it did in 2008. I'm predicting gold, which is $1,800 roughly today, will end up at 950 to 1,000 before commodities bottom. It'll still be the most stellar commodity. It'll still go down. Gold's not your safe haven. Cryptocurrency, give me a break. What went down the most? Bitcoin, more than everything, more than stocks, more than everything. I said that too. It's just the biggest bubble in this late stage. Crypto will be a big trend long term, but not now. It's got to shake out like the internet stocks did. So nothing, high quality bonds, particularly long-term treasury bonds, preserve your money, but you get a little interest, a little cash flow, but you get a deflation play. Even a 2% interest rate on those could go to near zero, and that bond goes up in value. So you might make 2% a year on the bond and 20 to 30 to 40% on the appreciation from interest rates going lower in a crisis. Nothing else, a junk bond or a risky bond will lose more in its value because of its default risk than it will gain from the deflation play. So there's not much. You can't buy utilities. You can't even buy healthcare stocks. Everything will go down when these values get deflated, except for what you just said, cash flow positive real estate's about the only thing other than high quality bond. So the highest quality cash flow real estate and the highest quality bonds are the only things that hold. And I went back to the Great Depression. I thought cigarettes, booze, casinos, toilet paper must go up. No, nothing went up except for those sectors right there in a big deflation. After that, things go up again according to demographics.
Gold at $1,000. That's what I got to say about that. So, all right, gang, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Are you looking for ways to improve your life?
Here at Jake and Gino, our mission is to empower students through financial education and the vehicle of multifamily investing.
Yes, Jake. We agree that a person with financial intelligence can change the world for the better.
We've created our proprietary three-step framework, Buy Right, Manage Right, and Finance Right, that we teach to our community. This framework, along with education, our one-on-one mentorship, on-site boot camps, and the amazing community, has propelled our students to massive success.
We've all been there. We've had so many students that have been able to shift their mindset, overcome limiting beliefs, and set a clear path to achieve their goals. Whether you're currently fixing and flipping, wholesaling, or buying single-family rentals, and you know that multifamily investing is the right vehicle for you, I encourage you to visit jakeandgino.com/apply to schedule your complimentary consultation with our team. And I want to let you know, this isn't a high pressure sales call. It's really just a discovery call to get to know each other better and see if we're a good fit for working together. And if for any reason we're not a good fit, our team has tons of resources we will share with you to help you along your journey.
If you're ready to stop spinning your wheels, go to jakeandgino.com/apply and schedule your call now. All right, we are back. There was one question that I didn't get in before that I want to hear from you. Demographic shifts after the boomers start to die. Not trying to get morbid here. What opportunities do you see as you transition from boomers to these other groups?
Well, you know the millennials will do what they do. They've been buying starter homes. They'll complete that cycle in the early years of the next boom, and then they will be getting into trade-up homes. So some of these McMansions, which get beat down, the higher end homes and the larger homes will get beat down more than the affordable homes. Same sort of thing, you know. Those are going to be the best deals, either to just, okay, buy these bigger end homes, rent them out, you know, until these millennials want to trade up to them, which they will, predictably. And the second trend we've seen is millennials, since they've waited so long to buy a starter home, some of them, when they finally buy one in their mid-30s instead of their late, you know, early 30s, like the baby boomers or late 30s, they end up saying, well, why don't I just buy my trade-up home now? Mm-hmm. So those McMansions could be good for that. The McMansions are good, and there are people doing this profitably. You convert them into assisted living facilities. Get in a network where you can access the expertise, host six or seven people in a 4,000-square-foot home. They're in a quiet neighborhood. They might be near their kids that live somewhere down the road, you know, instead of in some institutionalized place with low service at high cost. That's another thing to do. Apartments, again, coming out of this, you really got to target the aging baby boomers. So everything from retirement rental to assisted living and nursing homes will be the real estate plays to keep playing the baby boomers until they die. And they don't die until about 2040. So that's still a long play. Nursing homes, who are dominated by 84-year-old women, that's the peak spending on that, because there are no men left by 84, okay? Those are going to boom until 2042, and they are at their low in demographics right now. And I'd say nursing homes is the number one segment in the next boom, especially in real estate and demographic. And people say, yeah, but they're overbuilt and blah, blah, and they're a pain in the ass. They are a pain in the ass. Okay, I'll admit to that. Old, cranky people, pain in the ass. But they are at the bottom. Baby boomers are just starting to move into assisted living and nursing homes. So that's another area in real estate. If I got really good cash flow and doing well on apartments, I might consider getting into this McMansion turn into assisted living deal. Or turn apartment buildings into an assisted living facility and add a main court, you know. So that would be a really huge play. Take the cash flow positive real estate that can accommodate a lot of people and turn it into assisted living facility instead of an apartment. Or reposition that apartment building to appeal to the slightly higher income, higher service need retiring baby boomers.
My only fear with the single families and the millennials is that I have younger brothers. They're very tech oriented. They're not very good with their hands. I see their friends as the same. I see improvement and renovation costs. And I've heard from some of the millennials that have gotten to their first home and they're like, I have to do all this shit. I don't want to mess with this. So I'm just wondering if the home ownership, you know, even as they start to season, if you will, amongst millennials will be significantly lower due to growing up tech. You know, yeah. You have any thoughts on that?
No, I agree for two reasons. For that, owning a home sounds great. It is more maintenance. It is more responsibility. When I first sold my overvalued McMansion in Miami, moved to Tampa and rented a McMansion for half the carrying cost if I had bought it. And it fell 50%. The best value was this lady who rented it to me and went to Hong Kong had a manager when something went wrong. Our air conditioners broke, $20,000. The sprinklers came through the living room floor, $40,000. We didn't have to pay or deal. Mary just showed up with contractors and fixed it at the landlord's cost. So It is a pain in the ass, but also a lot of people have bought, whether they, you know, or not, because you got to buy a home. And it's the best way to become a millionaire. This will not be the case. That's what I meant at the beginning. I said, real estate will never be the same again. Real estate historically grows with the replacement cost and the value of its rental stream in an income or rental savings. That's a whole different dynamic then. It goes up because it's in a cool area and it's going up faster. So everybody's got to get on the bubble. there will be no bubble. No more bubbles in real estate for the rest of any of our lifetimes in developed countries like the U.S. If there is going to be a bubble, it's going to be in Mumbai, okay, where there's strong demographics. All the developed countries are aging. So real estate has got that danger. Millennials will probably never buy at the same rates that baby boomers did. Baby boomers bought more than the Bob Hope or World War II generation, and they bought way more than the Henry Ford. The Bob Hope generation bought higher houses because they had affordable mortgages for the first time and middle-class incomes for the first time. We didn't have a middle class before the assembly line coming out of World War II. I think the millennials, you're right, will be less inclined. They won't feel like they have to buy a home. I am happier than a pig, and you know what? Renting my primary home. I own a 25-acre, gorgeous island property with the best view in Puerto Rico because it's going from 25 to 5-acre zoning, and that's going to double the value of it right there. That's what I own. I have no problem sitting here in San Juan in this condo renting it because there's no appreciation value. And Puerto Rico's demographics, by the way, are horrible.
Mm-hmm. So, Jake, I just want to mention one thing. If you look back in the 1970s, when we got off the gold standard, you were buying homes for $20,000, $30,000. That's when inflation started. So back in the day, that's people have their memory of, oh, real estate always goes up. Oh, wait, stop that. And people were using their homes as ATM machines. I think millennials know that they're buying at these price points. It can't appreciate that much more. They're already over-levered, and they can't cash out on their homes. And I think they intuitively they understand that. And like you said, if you can rent, if your renting is cheaper than your mortgage and you're paying down your principal $7,000 or $8,000 for the year. But
and you don't have to manage the damn house and deal with the maintenance.
Yeah, so they know that intuitively. And like I said, if they're going to go to a gym, if they're going to go, it's all already baked into the carry cost. So it's really crazy. You just have to know your market, Jake. In Jacksonville here, they're building a ton of homes, 100,000 homes in St. John's County because it's a great school because there's such a huge migration. But I think in other parts of the country, just everyone out there, please understand what's going on in your market because it is very market specific and you need to know what's happening. The other problem in Florida here, they're building so much. There's so much land still. So there can be a glut, like Harry said. So just be careful. Don't buy for appreciation. Buy for comfort. Buy for home ownership. Buy for pride. But don't buy it and think it's an asset because it is not truly an
asset. Exactly. That's what I mean by real estate. I'll never be saying it's not a financial asset historically. Replacement cost. That's a zero return adjusted for inflation. It is a place to improve or to live in or do business in. And, and why? I tell businesses, why would you buy an office building when you could deploy the cash in growing your company or some higher value asset? People have only been doing it because the bubble has rewarded it. This bubble, mark my words, will be over in the next few years and will never come back in our lifetime. Never. Now, it may be in certain areas, in certain parts of the world. That's what changes about real estate. You buy it because of the value of the rents you're going to get, the cash flow you're going to get, or the value, or you because you can buy it, maybe because of good mortgage rates or you're in a good area or whatever, you can buy it and save money from renting. Otherwise, why not consider renting? Again, I have no problem renting as long as I can get a longer. I try to lock in things for 5 years. I don't want to have to move in 2 years.
Love that.
We get a lot of people in our community asking questions about debt and how to use debt. And I know a lot of the personal finance gurus out there, you have the Dave Ramseys that debt is the devil. And then you have some people that are like, no, business debt is the best. Where do you land and how do you recommend people to use debt?
Debt is great if you invest it productively. Okay. Buying bubbles is not, and renting out negative cash flow is not productive investment. Duh. Okay, this is a stupid, negative gearing is the stupidest thing. It's the sign you're in a bubble, as we said before. Yeah. So now, the other hand, people come to me and say, oh, Harry, I got two houses. One's got an 80% mortgage, but the other one I pretty much paid off. Boy, I should sell the one that's got the 80% mortgage to get rid of that debt. I'm like, no. You borrow that money cheap, you're getting a tax deduction for it. Blah, 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 blah. And guess what? Last time, they didn't force the banks to mark down to market and mark down mortgages and debt. Next time, they're going to have to. That game's going to be over. You may get a forgiveness on 30, 40, 50% of that mortgage, I would sell the house that's got all equity in it, take that money out, and go buy the greatest real estate or investments in the crash. I want to free up equity. If you sell the mortgaged house, you may have no equity or a little bit, so you don't get much to invest. And you're giving cheap money back to the banks who may go under and may have to forgive your half of your loan and give you a free gift. So that's the way to look at it. Is it productive debt? Not. Somebody's got debt against an apartment building, is positive cash flow. That's good debt. I wouldn't pay.
And it's non-recourse. Yes. And many times it's non-recourse. Yep.
Yeah. But you got bad debt. If I had a company with bad debt, I would sell that company, or I would try to renegotiate that loan now. Mm-hmm. But that's something I would sell at whatever price, because it's going to get worse. If you got debt that's unproductive, yeah, that may be forgiven only when you're in chapter 7.
We have a group here of personal growth junkies. Any books that you've read in the last few years that you'd like to recommend to the audience?
Well, you know, I've spoken for Tony Robbins for a long time. I speak at his platinum conferences every year. And he's got, people think he's a positive thinker stuff. He's got real human technology. I mean, he knows his stuff, and he knows the best experts. I am not the most famous economist. I am not the most known. He just knows I know my stuff. He knows that. He's a smart guy. So I like his stuff. There's a book I recommend everybody to read, and more important, to give to your, let's say, upper teenage, college plus kids, even if they're in their 20s or 30s. Factfulness by Hans Rosling. He looks at history just like I do and looks at all the statistics, what's really happening in the world. And I'm saying the world's going to go hell in a handbasket for the next 2 to 3 years. But he and I are both saying we're in an unprecedented economic explosion since the late 1800s. Things came together. I don't want to get into it here. He documents this. I document this. And that book is a must read. If your kids growing up will read my latest book and his book, Factfulness, they will know more about economics than any damn professor at Yale or Harvard. I am serious about that. They know a lot about crap that doesn't matter. This is all stuff. He just shows biggest decline in poverty ever. All these things. The world is getting better at the fastest rate. 8 times I show the standard of living since 1900 for the U.S. 8 times, and gold bugs are saying we're debasing our dollar and going broke. 8 times the standard of living adjusted inflation. This has never happened in history. Lifespans have gone from 40 to 80 in this time period in developed countries, and 30 to 70. You know what that's worth for demographics? Much bigger boom. People enter the workforce later. They spend longer. They retire longer. Everything grows because people live longer. That's the single most important thing that's happened along with information technologies in the last several decades, expansion of lifespan. So this is important stuff. Everybody should know this.
I think that pisses me off more than anything, you know, and I'm not going to get like crazy with the media here, but you turn on the news and it's like, oh, the world's coming to an end. And it's like, we have more quality of life. People are living longer, yet the country is evil. And it just, frankly, it pisses me off because.
Well, the biggest trend though is urbanization. We in the Western world urbanized over the 1800s, early 9, mid 900s. The third world emerge is industrializing to some degree, but urbanizing at a rapid rate, 3 times the GDP per capita to move an uneducated person from a rural area in Brazil to a city. Same in India and China where I've studied this. So that raises the standard of living, that raises healthcare, that raises lifespan. It's not the healthcare that's raising lifespan. People in urban areas have better jobs, better benefits, and all this other stuff, and therefore they live long. Better sanitation.
It should be celebrated, though, Harry, and that's the thing that pisses me off, is that this stuff is never talked about, and it's like, guys, we are killing it here, you know, you know, if you look at this stuff, but I never hear of it.
So, yeah. I tell people, if you want to get real, I wish there was a time machine so I could send people back to the 1800s. People say the good old days, I slap them. What the hell is wrong with you? Have you studied history? How brutal life was? Most people were peasants.
Yeah.
No, most people are middle class. that is 10 times as well off as
you those have air conditioning and a TV and internet. Shut the hell up.
Yeah. and how bad compared to working out, breaking your ass on a farm and dying from physical brutality or in a hot factory? How bad can life be working in an air conditioned office with health care? You know? So we live in unprecedented times. My cycles show we're in the middle of this explosion. It's a 250-year upcycle, the best one in history. This is just a big reset to get rid of all this bubble and excess debt stuff before we go on. How did life look after 29 to 32? That was the worst downturn. Real estate went down less. Stocks got creamed. Debt got deleveraged. 25% unemployment. How did life go after that? Extremely well. So I am the most bullish person in the world, as is Hans Rosling. He's dead, by the way. Another reason to get his book. It's just, at the same time, we've had such an extreme boom, and it's been so artificially extended by clueless economists and central bankers that we need to reset this thing before we can go on and get things back down to people, innovation, and reality instead of speculation and bubbles. People are making money doing nothing, sitting on their ass, watching their 75-inch TV, which is a tenth of the cost it was 10 years ago, and making money on real estate and stocks, doing nothing. That's not going to be the future.
What is the best way for folks to get a hold of you and your company if they'd like to work with you?
Yeah, best thing, harrydent.com. We have a free newsletter. You just put in your email there. You're on. You get to know us. We have other newsletters, hsdent.com, to learn more about us. But and again, my latest book is Zero Hour. I'm probably going to come out with one later this year. And again, I don't have many books to recommend. My books and Hans Rosling, that's about it. Nobody else understands what's going on because everybody thinks that government policies are the key. Government policies are the problem here. They caused this bubble. We would have been over this by 2010 and been booming again if they hadn't stepped in and decided, oh, let's just take some heroin and get rid of the pain. We've been on a morphine drip ever since. Japan's been on a morphine drip for 30 years now.
They're stuck.
That doesn't work out well.
Love that.
Gino, I know you got
peaceful way to the best thing I can say about it, and that's what's happening in Japan. So don't invest in Japan in anything.
Like that, Jake. I've got a lot of, I guess, recaps. It's just I could spend an hour recapping this, but high level points, everybody. The word real estate came from the Royales, right? You're talking about the time that we at least can own our property, right? Back in the day, in the feudal times, we were peasants, like Harry said.
Okay.
I challenge everybody, go back to look at the downfall of Rome. It's happening right now. They debased the currency. They started with a welfare state. That's why they lost. And that's why they, you know, for 1,000 years, they were really productive. They were controlling. But as soon as they started doing what we're doing, printing currency and their silver coins, and they started shaving their coins and they started debasing the currency, that's what happened. So it takes time. May not happen the next 10, 20, 30 years, but just see what's going on. Go back in the past because history does repeat itself. And the reason why I'm telling you this is we're talking about multifamily real estate. We're talking about the asset that you need to invest in. The next thing, Jake, they need to pick up this book, Demographic Cliff, so they can speak intelligently to their investors and tell them why and tell them going on with what's going on with the demographics and all the spending habits, because that's important. You need to sound educated when you're conveying a message and you're offering an opportunity to your investors. So pick up the Demographic Cliff. If it don't cash flow, let the grass grow.
Boom.
One of the most important things we talk about, remember the three pillars of real estate and the four reasons why we love multifamily. Mr. Stenzi, anything from you?
No, Harry, I love it. I love your energy and I love where your head's at and really appreciate you coming on today.
Thanks, Harry.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, sir.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.